Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about new materials that can wait until you feel pain and then deliver pain relief right there and then. It's a really cool smart material idea from the University of Cambridge. Stay with us to find out more. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us science@newstalk.com or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. First, though, it is time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. John Regan, who's a research fellow in the Department of Theoretical Physics at Maynooth University, and Dr. Laura Dungan, immunologist. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Laura, brings us back once again to GLP-1 and the class of obesity drugs that we have been talking about for so many years now.
Have people been talking about these, Johnny? I hadn't heard about these. No, I'm kidding. Obviously, it is the only thing anyone is talking about. So trade names are things like Ozempic or Mounjaro, which I think probably everybody at this point has heard of. They are injectable drugs that help people with diabetes, but they also help with weight loss. So they're very interesting and relatively new treatment. But these researchers in Yale who were using these injections in rats actually found, and I kind of often wonder how these serendipitous things are found. They found if they fed alcohol to the rats who were also on the Ozempic or the GLP-1 agonists, that there was less toxicity. And why this is because alcohol in itself, or ethanol, isn't really the biggest problem when you drink. The problem is that your body has to break it down, and it breaks it down into toxic metabolites. And those toxic metabolites are what destroy your liver cells, among many, many other things that the problems that causes in your body.
What do they do to the liver cells? I know this is a tricky question, but you are like a doctor.
They create a toxin called acetaldehyde, which is one of the breakdown products directly after ethanol. Now, it's only one of the breakdown products. So it is when a specific enzyme breaks down ethanol, and it is literally a poison. It destroys hepatocytes. So it's taken up into the cells and it's toxic and it causes cell death. And funny enough, you need your liver to be alive. But there are other metabolites. So alcohol can actually be broken down in different ways. But this CYP protein, this CYP2E1, is the one that breaks it down into acetaldehyde. So what the Ozempic or the GLP-1 agonists do is they actually block this enzyme. So the alcohol can't be broken down into the toxic byproduct. So it gets broken down into a safer product, but much more slowly. So it's kind of an interesting one where they in no way have recommended that this is going to be a treatment to reduce alcohol toxicity. I mean, obviously, the way to reduce alcohol toxicity is to not drink alcohol. But the concept is that you will be drunk for longer, but it will be safer in the long term. Now, I'm not recommending any of this, but it is just very interesting. So the alcohol stays in your system for longer. So the ill effects of the ethanol, so the neuropsychological effects, essentially being drunk, last for longer because you can't break it down as quickly. But when it's broken down in a safer way. So no one's recommending that we do this, but it is just really interesting.
Well, obviously this is not what the drug was designed for, and I don't believe it's even intended to affect the liver, right? What's going on there?
Yeah, it's just because so a lot of the time when we take drugs or medications that have been approved, there are a lot of off-target effects. And this is why people assess the safety of medications. So if something is working as, say, an agonist, which means it binds to something and blocks something else, or an antagonist, it doesn't always just work on exactly what you want it to work on. So it binds to this enzyme, which is in the liver, and it blocks its function. And this is just an off-target effect. And it happens all the time in medication. But it's just something that hadn't really been realized up until now. So it's kind of fascinating, but a little bit unusual. So there probably will be recommendations for people on GLP-1 agonists and alcohol intake, but I am not going to be the one to make those recommendations.
Exactly. We've talked about the benefits of these things, and there are, like, I'm waiting for someone to say, actually, turns out GLP-1 gives you 3 arses or something, because we have had so many positive stories from it. What are the negatives? Because there's a lot of faff out there. Like, I know this, again, isn't necessarily your area, but do we know what the negatives are of taking GLP-1 at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the biggest negative is generally that they're very, very poorly tolerated in some people. So you usually start on quite a low dose and you can get really, really horrible gastrointestinal side effects. So nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, and people can find them really, really, really difficult to take. Some people tolerate them really well. There is some rapid weight loss, which can cause problems with the gallbladder. You can get problems with your pancreas, pancreatitis. It doesn't necessarily help with all of the side effects of diabetes. So, for instance, retinopathy for the diabetic. But they are largely thought to be very safe and effective medications, but just a lot of people find them really difficult to tolerate.
Very good. John, our second story has to do with an asteroid.
Yeah, that's right, Jonathan. So it is a crater, actually, that's been discovered in the North Sea. Funnily enough, when I heard this, the first thing I thought about the North Sea was oil drilling. And sure enough, it actually was found through oil. So they dig oil wells there and then the oil guys run seismic activity measurements. And they're the ones who actually discovered the crater about 20 years ago. But a team at Harriet Watt University have followed up with it. And there was debate in the community, it seems, about whether this was an asteroid impact crater or not. But the latest evidence seems to suggest that, yes, it is an impact crater from an asteroid from about 35 million years ago. So quite a long time ago. The asteroid itself was estimated to be about 160 meters across. So I think that's kind of like the size of Crow Park.
Right.
Right. I think ballpark figure, for want of a better pun.
Is that big asteroid in the history of asteroids, as far as we know?
So there's a scaling, right? So smaller asteroids are more common, medium ones less common, and the big ones really uncommon. Now, if you're asking about the biggest ones that hit, and they're kind of the most interesting, right? So the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, that was about 55 million years ago, hit the Yucatan Peninsula just off the coast of Mexico, and that had a radius or diameter, I'm not sure which, but doesn't matter, of about 15 kilometers.
Right,
so this is like the size of Dublin, right?
Okay.
Massive. So Crow Park versus one. Dublin, right? And yeah, so and of course the effects scale as well. So the one that the people from Harriet Watt looked at, again, that's 160 kilometers, so you're Crow Park sized. That would have been locally devastating. You would have a 100-meter high tsunami. So very, very serious. If that hits a city or a country, you're in serious, serious trouble. But you don't get a global extinction event.
Right. Okay. 100-meter tsunami isn't a global extinction event. That's actually something, because you think about 100 meters.
Yeah, it's very serious, but it's more local. Like, it doesn't affect the climate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? You don't get an ecological disaster. If a big one hits, your 10-kilometer one hits anywhere, then everybody's down, right? And that's what, obviously heralded at the end of the dinosaurs. As far as we know, it wiped out somewhere between 75 and 90% of the species at the time. So it had huge impacts. And it's even difficult, I think, to get your head around what the kind of impact of that would be. You get, obviously, earthquakes are going off everywhere, all the time. Day turns to night for God knows how long. It would have been, an incredible event. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah. But this new crater, do we see what it looks like? I mean, could our seabeds be covered in these craters that we can't see because they're underwater?
So yeah, there will be an element to that. But again, it goes back to the kind of scaling thing again as well. How often would you expect to be hit by an asteroid of that size? So again, that was 160 meters. So that's pretty big. Back in 2013, an asteroid hit a place in Russia called Chelyabinsk, and that had a diameter of, I think it was 20 meters or something like that, 20 or 30 meters. And actually, we've good dash cam footage actually of something like that. So you could see that one coming across the sky. In fact, if you go onto YouTube, there's some really cool videos of that event, and there's nothing bad on YouTube, so you don't need to worry, obviously. What do you say? And everything is true.
Exactly.
But that one was, you know, you can actually see this fireball going across the sky, and it landed in a lake, and people, you know, they dug it out of the lake, and it didn't kill anyone. It just it blew out windows, so it blew up in the sky. But like, even that one, and that was 20 meters, and so that's smaller than the one that the Harriet Watt people looked at in the North Sea. But that's still, in terms of force, that's multiple nuclear bombs. So it is a big event. You know, the ones that make it to the ground and are bigger, they're like thousands of nuclear weapons, because it's the speed they're coming in at. So these things are hypersonic when they hit the atmosphere. So it's just purely the speed. So if you think, I don't want to do equations on air, but like, if you think of kinetic energy as basically mv squared, or well, half mv squared. So that v is the squared. So the things that are traveling very fast have a huge impact. And these things hit our atmosphere, like I said, at hypersonic. So they're multiple times the speed of sound. And it's that really force of that explosion that causes all the damage.
Do you know what we should do? We should figure out how often we get hit by things this size and see when the next one is due. That'll be a bit of crack to it and wake people up with it.
So we are overdue. We're overdue.
Yeah. Okay, overdue. That's great. That's great to hear, John. Let's end on that. So I wanted to do something on the Ig Nobel Awards as well, because we often talk about the serious stories, you know, about health and about, you know, asteroids destroying the planet. But the Ig Nobels are a fantastic awards ceremony which recognize kind of what sounds like really silly research, but actually realized there's actually an interesting point to it. So, Lara, what were you looking at?
Yeah, so like you said, it's supposed to make you laugh first and then think. I'm going to take you back to 1930s America in DuPont, and a man called Roy Plunkett is trying to make a new refrigeration material. And instead, by accident, he makes Teflon. So most people have heard of Teflon. It's the non-stick at the bottom of your frying pan. It was also used in the Manhattan Project to line all their tubes to stop uranium from breaking it down. And it was basically used as a non-stick substance for a long time after that. And then let's fast forward to 2016, which is when this paper was published. The Ig Nobel Awards don't necessarily need to have been in the last year or two. They just recognize research that's been very interesting in the last while. And there are researchers over in New Jersey who have decided that Teflon is going to be the way to deal with weight loss. So we've already talked about the weight loss drug GLP-1. This is a very different way of doing it. So what they did is they published a paper where they bulked up diet with Teflon. Yes, Teflon. So they fed it to rats, thankfully not to people. Teflon is a plastic. There's no other way around it. Now, there was some basic research done in the 60s when people wanted to start using it in frying pans to make sure that it wasn't overtly toxic in small amounts. So there is research to show that. But they have published this research about just nearly 10 years ago now, that if you fill a quarter of the bulk of food with rats with Teflon, because it has no taste, it can't be absorbed, it's theoretically safe, but there's absolutely no evidence for that, then the rats will lose weight. Now, it's not the world's greatest paper. I have read it start to finish, and they in no way tell you how much weight the rats have lost. So it is a proof of concept. The idea is that it's non-toxic to these rats. They don't talk about the actual weight loss.
So what the research actually says, if you fill up your stomach with something that will not be absorbed, you feel hungry, and then that stuff comes out. And so that's a good way to lose weight. Is that honestly what they're suggesting?
Yeah, I mean, it's the concept of bulking. Stomach stretch is a real thing. So the fuller you get, the more your stomach stretches, the more it should stimulate your vagus nerve to stop you being hungry. And that is real. That is true. It doesn't work for me, but it's supposed to work for normal people. But yeah, so the idea is, I suppose, in theory is sound, but the reality of eating plastic in large amounts with no evidence of safety is not perfect. But they are not suggesting that you do this yet or at all.
No, and Ruth Freeman has been on this program talking about non-stick coatings and forever chemicals and how these are carcinogens in some cases, so they can be quite dangerous. John, our final story is another Ig Nobel. What were you looking at?
I was looking at smelly shoes, right? So it was a study. So it was 2021, and it was by two researchers in India. I guess the climate and, you know, it's hot and sticky, they do have a problem with smelly shoes. And they put them on their shoe racks, and it stinks. What they describe it as, it smells like rotten cheese. And this is a problem. So they have to keep their shoes outside, and they're trying to find a better way to approach how to mitigate the smell. And what they suggest, what they try is UV light. So that doesn't sound unreasonable. And the reason they do it is because it seems to be a fairly pervasive thing and people don't know what to do. So their experiment was they put the shoes, they used athletes' shoes. They went to a student hostel and they found the athletes there. So it was a fairly small sample. And they took their shoes and smelled them. They used humans to smell the shoes because they tried sensors and the sensors were all over the shop. And like so unreliable. You need the humans to tell you if it's rotten cheese or not.
All right. Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. You need a human to go there. That stinks. Yeah. That's great.
I think so.
Did they do that in front of the people who own the shoes?
Yeah. They were at least human, so they were a bit more relaxed
about
it.
Yeah. Yeah. Your feet stink. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
They put them into a box, turn on the UV light, and they found after 2 minutes that the smell completely disappeared. It was perfect. Now, the smell was replaced by the smell of burning rubber. So they actually fried the shoes, right? So there was a disadvantage, right?
Well, is it possible that the smell was still there, but it was actually masked by the smell of burning rubber? We can't, like the sensors are all over the shop. I can't imagine humans are going to be able to figure that one out.
I'm a bit like Lara's problem. When I read the paper, it was light on those kind of details.
You know what? It's interesting to hear about research that's going on in all parts of the world and for all sorts of things. John Regan and Lara Duggan, thank you so much for joining us. Now, imagine if your joints could sense when your arthritis was flaring up and deliver pain relief exactly where it's needed, right on cue. No injections, no GP visits, just intelligent materials. Well, this is the work of Professor Oren Sherman. He's a professor of supramolecular and polymer chemistry at the University of Cambridge. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Oren. I suppose we've been thinking for quite some time about smart materials and different ways to deliver drugs and medicines to places where it's needed immediately and on demand. But this is a really cool idea. So set the scene. What are we talking about here?
We're talking about a hydrogel, which is a collection of a lot of water molecules that instead of being in a liquid state are in a jelly-like state. And we create that jelly-like state by putting in a small quantity of polymer. So the polymer and water mix together and they form this jelly-like material. And inside that material, we can put small molecules that might be drugs. We can put larger molecules like proteins as well. And they can be delivered through a diffusive mechanism from the gel, the depot, to the surrounding tissue. And if we utilize gels that don't create an inflammatory problem themselves in the body, so if we use something that's going to be biologically okay, then we can embed the gel into a joint or into a location where we want to deliver the local drug or protein or whatever we might want to deliver from inside. And we hopefully can control that so it happens over an elongated period of time, not just a few minutes or seconds, but hours, weeks, even months. And that would be extremely nice opportunity to bypass any type of systemic mechanism where we take something through an oral delivery or an injection, and then it goes throughout all of the body and hopefully, you know, accumulates in the location where we want. So that's one of the ways that we get around or get to local delivery. But the gel also has another purpose. It can accommodate different levels of squishiness or different levels of resistance to and rigidity.
Yeah.
And what we are hoping to do is not just deliver things in a smart manner, but we have a level of intelligence so that the body can create a signal and then change the rigidity of that gel, which also in turn affects the rate of release of whatever is inside the gel. Drugs, small molecules.
Wow.
And so the hope is here that if there's a flare-up, such as a joint, when you have an arthritic flare-up, the pH of the surrounding tissue can, in fact, drop a little bit. And it can go from roughly neutral to perhaps something in the lower 6 or 5.5 or so pH level.
And that's more acidic?
It's more acidic, yes, sorry. So as the joint becomes more acidic, it is going to signal to the gel, hey, I'm now acidic. And that gel is going to see the acid, and it's going to change its stiffness. And as it changes its stiffness, based upon, again, the signals that the body is putting out endogenously by itself, it's going to then increase the release of whatever cargo it's holding. And so hopefully this is a way of, let's say, masking pain or delivering, you know, a pain medication, maybe a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent directly in the location where you want it.
That is very, very cool. So slow release of chemicals and medicine is not a new idea. I mean, the coil has been around for decades, you know, slow release of hormones to prevent women from ovulating. But it's not reactive to the environment. It's just a slow release. The idea that you could create something that would respond to changes in the environment, and then presumably when that prompt is gone, when the flare up is over, the lack of acidity would mean that the gel goes back to its normal state of waiting for the next flare up. I mean, that is a really, really incredible idea. Mechanistically, like the mechanics of that, how do you go about creating something like that in terms of a material?
So we use host-guest chemistry. So we use small molecules that are attached to polymer chains. And those small molecules that are guests, they have an acid group attached to them. And again, under acidic conditions, they exist in a certain protonated state. And under...
What does that mean?
Okay, so that means that they carry an OH at the end, the carboxylic acid. And again, that's taking the signals of the flare-up where you have more acid around. And when they're in that protonated state, they have a certain stiffness. And when you have a deprotonation, meaning that you go back to its kind of neutral pH state, the certain characteristics of the acid chemical that's sitting off the or attached to the polymer chain, it can become deprotonated. And when it's in a deprotonated state, it carries a minus charge on the carboxylic acid. And that minus charge completely changes the way that that small molecule engages in the chains. And so that change of having a minus charge or not having a minus charge completely changes the way in which the chains of the polymer interact with one another. And that changes the modulus, the stiffness of the gel.
Right. So the physical properties of this gel are modulated and changed by the acid. That's
the presence of an OH versus at the end of the carboxylic acid versus an O minus. Yep.
And so when you're thinking about drug delivery in this amazing material, do you just dot the sort of, you know, an anti-inflammatory drug in you know, across, is it built into the material? How is an anti-inflammatory released? I mean, because the shape of something or the rigidity of something is interesting, but how does that affect drug release?
The small molecules are mixed in together with water and the polymeric chains, and then they get trapped within the gel. And they're not attached to anything in the gel, they're just trapped there. It's, I guess, like making the equivalent of chocolate chip cookies, right? You have a dough, you put chocolate chips in, they kind of get trapped within the dough. And as the gel exists, you will have a normal rate at which those small molecule drugs will kind of diffuse outwards from the gel. However, when you're in a more squishy state or a stiffer state, that will just change the rate at which those drugs are released to the surrounding environment.
Right. Because the squishiness releases more of the molecules because it's more fluid in a way.
Potentially more fluid. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more here that's going on, and some drugs may carry a certain charge and you may have electrostatic repulsions or electrostatic forces that hold the small molecule drugs in closer proximity when you have, again, the minus charge versus no charge along the polymeric backbone. But in general, we have the ability to control the rate at which the small molecule diffuses out of the depot to the surrounding tissue on the basis of how squishy or stiff the gel is.
That is so cool. So what about the body? Because the body is, you know, it doesn't like foreign things, as we know. If you have this this gel that's, you know, reacting to acid and has its own inbuilt chemicals and molecules, how do you ensure that the body doesn't reject it and create an inflammatory response to get rid of the gel?
So that's a great question. What we have really worked on over the last decade and decade and a half in my lab is to look at the mechanism of how we can bring polymer chains together in a dynamic manner, meaning that polymer chains are held together, fall apart, held together, fall apart. That's what creates the scaffold under which the gel is kind of formed. That is a pretty generic mechanism, and it can be applied to a wide range of different polymers. So in the paper that has been highlighted here, we've just used a pretty simple acrylamide backbone, but you could do the same kind of chemistry and augment how squishy or stiff the material is utilizing polysaccharides. And one of the important polysaccharides is hyaluronic acid. It's a major component of the ECM. It's also a major component of the synovial fluid that is actually at the joints itself. And
is that the one that's in all of the beauty products at the moment?
It is also something that's used in many beauty products, but it's naturally occurring in our body, and it's not going to be rejected by the body. And so actually, we can do the same chemistry onto the hyaluronic acid backbone and use it as a drug depot. In fact, some of our work over the last 15 years or so has tried to target delivery to the brain for brain cancer, glioblastoma in particular, again, using hyaluronic acid gel depots, but with a different type of drug, obviously.
Right. Okay. It sounds very complicated. Like, compared to an injection on the site or rubbing a gel on your joints, what are the benefits of your approach versus, you know, rubbing a gel or taking a pill?
Right. So taking a pill, the drug is going to go through your entire body. There's not going to be a selective way in which to take the body that you've taken through an oral medication. And taking an injection is a great way of localizing things. And certainly we could introduce this type of gel through an injection into the body. The beauty of having things like hyaluronic acid as the gel component is that you often won't have to retrieve it at a later point because it's not necessarily going to be seen as a foreign body material. Moreover, a lot of hyaluronic acid-based materials can be chopped up naturally in the body through an enzyme called hyaluronidase, which is naturally occurring. And so we've also shown that a lot of the modified hyaluronic acids that we use to make these gels can be readily chopped up, and they don't also show foreign body responses in at least a range of animal studies that have been carried out in the past.
Is there any danger of all the drugs being released at once?
So that's a real concern that, of course, is important in any type of regulatory process. And we need to show that, you know, what is the total amount of the drug that would be released in case everything just went at one point and failed?
Yeah.
And in most cases, when you're dealing with localized delivery, the overall amount of drug can be significantly reduced such that you'd never be above a too high a value as if you were taking something in an oral systemic formulation.
So what you're saying is that, you know, people now, they might pop two paracetamol tablets if they have a headache. That's 1,000 milligrams of paracetamol. Mm-hmm. And that paracetamol goes all over the place as well as to where you want it to go.
Sure.
And so if you had it just go to the nerves where you're getting this headache, you wouldn't need anywhere near that sort of level of concentration. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. So obviously this would be really useful in certain environments, in joints, as you say. I kind of feel like there's a lot of impact around joints. There's a lot of movement. How do you protect the structure from just being bashed into a pulp and not delivering its job?
So part of the beauty of these types of gels is they can take a huge amount of impact. And we've shown that they are resilient and robust. In fact, the lead author on this paper, Dr. Stephen O'Neill, at the early part of his PhD, showed that we could actually make a gel and drive over it with a car and the water wouldn't go anywhere. So the materials can be as strong as that of bone, gigapascal, or down to the squishiness of brain matter. Yeah,
that's a real super glue ad right there, isn't it? You know, where they get super glue and they glue a train to somebody. Okay, that's really cool. And then, in terms of the sort of places, then it can go. The body's quite accommodating, isn't it? I mean, I found out recently that you could sneak a can of Coke into someone's stomach, and most people wouldn't even notice. I hadn't realized it. So we have lots of space in there. And so the hydrogels you're talking about, how big are they? I mean, would we notice them? Would we feel them?
Injections might be on the form, on the volume of a few hundred microliters. They could be on, you know, multi-gram scale, right? So, when we talk about lining the cavity after a brain surgery with this material, we're not talking about putting the entire volume that might be removed. We're really talking about utilizing a really small spreading of this gel-like material onto the biological tissue. In the knee, that would need to be tested, of course, by working together with people from a wide range of both biophysics, engineering, and other types of backgrounds. But we could very well imagine that the type of resistance to scraping or bones hitting against each other might come about from very, very small and thin gel materials. So we're really talking about small quantities of material if necessary, but larger amounts of material if necessary as well for the specific application.
There are some materials that respond, hydrogels that respond to different types of stimuli. So heat or ultrasound or light, for example. Is that something that is also being looked at, activating a different release by perhaps shining a bright light on the area, or ultrasound or something, so you can actually, without invasively performing surgery on someone, activate the release of pain medication immediately?
Absolutely. So we have looked at a wide range of stimuli that can be used to augment the squishiness or stiffness of a gel, or to trigger a release mechanism that includes light, both in UV but also in the visible range, which is much better for working with body and tissue. We also have looked at slight heat elevation because the body can accommodate slight decreases in temperature and increases in temperature localized for a short period of time. pH, as we have discussed, also magnetic engagement and just interaction and rupture, right, through mechanical means. So there are plenty of ways that we're interested in utilizing different stimuli to trigger a change in the material, either for mechanical purposes or for delivery purposes or both.
Very cool.
And what's, I think, taking it to the next step is that letting the body trigger that itself.
Yeah. And I guess understanding then the environment in which these hydrogels are existing and how they listen for cues and what cues are pathogenic or what cues are likely to be causing pain. It's a really cool area. Very, very, very quickly, how close are you to the patient?
That's a great question. We've been working for 15 years or so in glioblastoma. We have a route to getting towards patients. We've engaged with a range of PPIs and groups all over the UK to get patient and advocacy feedback. In the area of cartilage, I think we're further away. But also, since we've shown that these materials can readily go into the body, once perhaps we get through regulatory hurdles for going through, let's say, targeting brain cancer, getting them into joints should be much, much faster from a regulatory standpoint. But we still have a ways to go. We're really at the bench top, and we're excited about the translation capability, working together with colleagues from across a wide range of other departments that can really help us move this forward to patients.
Very cool.
I would love to see that happen within the next decade to 15 years.
Oh, wow. The far out, I suppose. Look.
Well, materials take time, right? Giving a realistic view to your listeners. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Professor Oren Sherman from the University of Cambridge, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Looking back now at some of your comments from last week, we had Professor Maria McNamara from University College Cork talking about dinosaur eggs that were dated correctly or directly for the very first time using a technique they used on rocks. Aaron says, were they able to tell the type of dinosaur who would have had those eggs from the shape, color, etc.? Because we don't have color, it's just the shape, but generally have a pretty good idea, Aaron, is my understanding. If you go to Dublin Zoo, actually, they have a good little exhibit, and it shows you different types of dinosaur eggs. So if they've been identified before, you would have a fairly good idea that those were those eggs, yeah. And we were also speaking to Professor Sanjeev Gupta, who's from Imperial College London. He works on the rover missions on Mars, and they found these leopard spots on rocks that are so far the clearest sign yet that life may have been on Mars. And he says, the aliens are obviously hiding, Jonathan. They're just really, really good at it. Lisa says, is it just me, but knowing life may have existed on Mars just wouldn't be the same as life does exist on Mars. Yes, yes, indeed, Lisa. You are absolutely right. Knowing it for sure is a totally different ballgame. Because I guess theoretically now we know life may have existed on Mars. Until we get those samples back and know for sure, then we're still in the dark. And someone says, I suggest naming Future Proof to Past Proof because of closed-minded attitudes to dark matter. Regards, Bernard via email. This is in reference to the fact that I refuse to accept the presence of something called dark matter or dark energy. I just think they're made up. And they're made up because we've never been able to measure them. We just guess they're there because we look at the mathematics and it says there's something there. And then we've said, well, I think it's dark matter and dark energy. I just don't think these are real concepts until I've seen them. And actually, someone made up a very good point, though, last week that we inferred black holes were there by the maths before we actually measured and recorded and actually spied where they were in the universe. So that did take away a little bit of my confidence, I have to be honest. That is very true. But I feel like our measurements and our understanding has gotten so much better that it's just not satisfying enough for me as a layperson who has no skin in the game that dark matter and dark energy are just, that we just know they're there because the maths add up. It's not enough. If you're interested, by the way, I interviewed one of the guys behind the concept. And he was very frank about it. He said, you know what? I'm not certain that this is where we're at. I'm not certain dark energy, dark matter are a thing. Have a look at it in our podcast feed. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo de Silva Scott on sound. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.